Today is Thursday, the 2nd of September, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. As the Taliban starts governing Afghanistan, it's facing a looming crisis.
Prices for vegetables were up to 50% higher, according to vendors, while petrol prices were up by 75%.
Plus, UNICEF warns of a water supply shortfall in Lebanon.
It is a catastrophe. A catastrophe. We have nothing.
We'll have these stories and more next. As Kabul, Afghanistan begins a new era of Taliban rule, long lines outside banks and soaring prices in the bazaars underline the everyday worries now facing its population after the spectacular seizure of the city 2 weeks ago. Reuters reporter Soroya Ali starts us off.
The new era of Taliban rule in Afghanistan was marked by the departure of foreign troops, bloody attacks on civilians by Islamic State, and now an economic crisis. The country has a sinking currency and rising inflation. More than a third of the population lives on less than $2 a day. Banks, which closed as soon as the Taliban took Kabul, have now been ordered to reopen. But that means hours of queuing thanks to strict weekly limits on cash withdrawals. Many offices and shops are still shut, and some salaries have been unpaid for weeks, meaning even the relatively well-off are struggling to put food on the table. This man is a market vendor.
2 weeks ago, the market was good and people were buying. But now the situation's not good and no one's buying. And people's money's stuck in the banks and no one has money to buy anything.
This market in Kabul has been flooded with people desperate to sell their goods. Remittances from abroad have also been cut off, so many families are trying to sell jewelry or household goods, even if they have to accept a fraction of their value. Prices for vegetables were up to 50% higher, according to vendors, while petrol prices were up by 75%. Taliban officials have said the problems will ease once a new government is in place, but the structural problems run deep. The country has no significant exports to generate revenue, and aid, which accounted for more than 40% of economic output, has abruptly disappeared.
Reuters' Soroya Ali. Heavy fighting has started between Taliban fighters and anti-Taliban resistance forces based in the Panjshir Valley after talks between the two sides failed to resolve their differences. A resistance spokesperson claims the Taliban offensive was repulsed, with the Taliban suffering heavy losses. The resistance is led by Ahmad Massoud, the son of the well-known anti-Taliban resistance leader from the 1990s, Ahmad Shah Massoud. The elder Massoud, who led the Northern Alliance against the Taliban, was killed by al-Qaeda militants posing as journalists just before the September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States. After the fall of Kabul last month, members of the Afghan security forces from across the country who felt betrayed by the surrender of their military leaders made their way to Panjshir to join the resistance. Among them were some of the special forces. Among them were some of the special forces, famous for their battlefield victories against the Taliban over the years, as well as the first vice president of the deposed regime, Amrullah Saleh. On Wednesday, the Taliban had blocked all traffic on the main road linking Panjshir to neighboring Gulbahar. Each side has blamed the other for the failures of the talks between the two sides. So, what other challenges face the Taliban and the U.S. diplomatic efforts in the region? Those questions are some of the ones I put to RAND Corporation policy researcher Jason Campbell.
I think in general, everything at this moment, for understandable reasons, remains very much in flux. I think that the regional actors who are most immediately impacted by increased threats within Afghanistan are largely taking a wait-and-see approach as the new Taliban regime, or however it's going to form itself, becomes more prominent, and are sort of trying to gauge the extent to which the Taliban are going to be able to tamp down the threat from extremism that comes from a number of groups that they've, you know, very closely associated with over the years.
Does the fact that the Taliban has, as of yet, not announced what they plan will be their government pose any problems or concerns that people should be aware of?
Well, the immediate concern is that, you know, from a just a general diplomatic standpoint, you know, there are limited individuals with whom the international community can engage with in a more formal capacity. As you know, things play out in Afghanistan, and as this new government is going to be formed, you see nations like China and Russia, in particular, sending or engaging in meetings with some of their high-ranking officials, with elements of the Taliban. In trying to, you know, extend some offer of willingness to recognize the new regime in exchange for assurances, again, that extremism will not seep over into their respective countries or regions, and that, in some cases, that there may be more normalized economic and other benefits from a more of a transactional relationship. But I think everyone is generally moving very cautiously when it comes to Afghanistan and the Taliban regime.
On Monday evening, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that the military mission to Afghanistan was over, but that the diplomatic mission was just beginning, and the United States was going to have its base of operations, so to speak, based out of Qatar in Doha. What do you see as perhaps the strengths or the challenges that are facing U.S. diplomatic efforts in the region with the U.S. mission now in Doha?
Well, the most immediate and direct challenge is obviously being able to process and deal with the number of not only remaining U.S. citizens in the country, but also numerous thousands of those Afghan special immigration visa applicants who have supported the United States in some form or fashion over the years who remain in Afghanistan. That's going to be very difficult to do from Doha. And besides that, again, the engagement with the Taliban regime, or what will become of it in terms of its senior leadership, is obviously going to be much more difficult doing it from a distance than if you were in the country. Though for the time being, given the very tenuous security situation on the ground in Kabul, it's understandable that without a security presence in country, that U.S. diplomats would have to move elsewhere, if only temporarily.
Jason Campbell is a policy researcher and Middle East expert at the RAND Corporation. Among the growing numbers of Afghans arriving in Turkey after fleeing the Taliban are those who fought alongside NATO forces. As Dorian Jones reports, they're now looking for help from the countries that they once worked for.
Yusuf, an Afghan military helicopter pilot, shows photos of the NATO forces he fought alongside against the Taliban. That collaboration, he says, made him a target, forcing him to flee to Istanbul just before the Taliban seized Kabul. Now he's seeking a visa to one of the NATO countries.
Our advisors, they were from British, they were from US, they were from Germans. We worked shoulder by shoulder in making some plan against insurgents. Right now, we are in the situations we can't stay in Afghanistan, because all our database, our info, there's in the hand of the Taliban.
Listening to Yusuf is his friend, also an Afghan pilot, who does not want to be identified. He came to Istanbul 3 months ago after receiving Taliban death threats. Showing his numerous visa applications to NATO countries, he says Yusuf could be in for a long wait.
And I tried Germany, and then I tried Canada. I still haven't got luck with any. I've worked with Germans, I've worked with British. We worked side by side, planning missions, doing missions. But when there's a bad time for you, if you don't get a help from a friend or a colleague, it's very disappointing and very frustrating.
The Afghan pilots live in Istanbul's Zeytinburnu district. dubbed by locals Afghan Borno because of its large Afghan population. Many here fled the Afghan conflict years ago. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is ruling out taking in any new wave of Afghans, saying the country is already hosting nearly 5 million refugees, mainly from the Syrian civil war. The Turkish government is even refusing to allow NATO countries to use Turkey to process Afghans seeking visas.
Turkish governments are not registering them inside Turkey, or they can't apply for asylum inside Turkey. So when they are living in Turkey, they are living as illegal refugees, as illegal people.
The two pilots are staying on tourist visas, which will soon expire. In the last few days, Yusuf's friend got some good news that his wife and three children were evacuated from Kabul, and the United States is now looking into his case. But Yusuf thinks about his wife and two children still trapped in Kabul.
I'm just thinking about my family. If they are safe, I'm safe right now. First of all, I think about their life, nothing else.
While neither man knows when or if they will leave Istanbul and be reunited with their families, both say they're lucky to have escaped the Taliban. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The UN Children's Agency, more commonly known as UNICEF, has warned that more than 4 million people in Lebanon, many of them children, could face a critical shortage of water in the coming days. The water crisis comes on top of a fuel crisis and a plummeting currency as Lebanon's economy collapses and plunges millions into poverty. Anshel Vohra has the details.
Every day, the residents of Ras Al Naba, a middle-class neighborhood in Beirut, line up for hours to get free drinking water from a mosque and to purchase it for other needs from local water tanker owners.
It is a catastrophe, a catastrophe. We have nothing.
A fuel crisis in the hottest month of the year has not just turned off the air conditioners, but also the pumps that distribute water throughout the country.
We have no water, no cooking gas, and no fuel for the generator. We only get electricity 3 to 4 hours a day.
The municipal water system is no longer working, and bottled water in the market is far too expensive for many. The mosque is the only source for many. For cleaning and washing, people rely on privately owned water tankers. Ibrahim Kobrusil, the sheikh of the mosque, blames the country's political elite for leaving the people thirsty.
Since the beginning of the revolution and the financial crisis, there has been an electricity crisis, and because of it, water is not being pumped to major tanks that supply houses with water. It is a political issue, not the people's fault.
With Lebanon running dry, local UNICEF official Etty Higgins says the poor will be disproportionately affected.
We saw the collapse, more or less, of the national electricity grid on the 16th of August. And since then, we think that at least 2.8 million people have been affected by the water shortages in the country. And unfortunately, some of these are the most vulnerable population groups.
UNICEF is getting ready to deploy rapid response teams in collaboration with local agencies to provide water and emergency supplies of fuel to run water pumps in several parts of the country. Also, the Iranian-backed Hezbollah is promising emergency oil deliveries, a dangerous proposal, some say, that could bring on U.S. sanctions and stoke tensions with Israel. For the thirsty people of Lebanon in the blistering heat, the options are becoming fewer. Anshel Vohra for VOA News, Beirut.
The World Meteorological Organization says that the number of weather disasters related to climate change and extreme weather events has been increasing over the past 50 years, while the number of deaths has decreased due to preventive measures. The WMO's just-released Atlas of Mortality and Economic Losses from Weather, Climate, and Water Extremes tracks and analyzes trends between 1970 and 2019. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
The World Meteorological Organization report notes more than 11,000 weather-related disasters have occurred during the 50-year period, causing more than 2 million deaths and economic losses of $3.64 trillion. That constitutes a five-fold increase in natural disasters and a three-fold decrease in deaths. WMO Secretary General Petteri Tala says fewer people are being killed thanks to early warning systems, which have saved thousands of lives. He says economic losses, however, have been growing very rapidly and are expected to continue to climb.
We are going to see more climatic extremes because of climate change, and this negative trend in climate will continue for the coming decades anyhow. And if we are successful with climate mitigation, we could stop this negative trend around 2060s. And if we are most lucky, we could limit it, the warming, to 1.5 degrees.
The report finds more than 90% of deaths are in developing countries, while nearly 60% of losses due to economic damage are in wealthier countries. The top 10 deadliest weather disasters have been droughts, storms, floods, and increasingly heat waves. The WMO reports the five costliest disasters since 1970 were storms in the United States. Topping the list is Hurricane Katrina, which hit the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, in 2005 and incurred economic losses of more than $163 billion. On the other hand, the chief of the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction, Mamie Mizutori, says enhanced early warning and preventive measures are saving many lives. The most recent example, she says, is Hurricane Ida, which battered the same area Sunday. While Hurricane Katrina killed more than 1,800 people, she notes Ida claimed a handful of lives.
What made the difference this time is that the city designed a new hurricane and storm damage risk reduction system, investing $14.5 billion in gates, flood walls, and levees that protected this once-in-a-century storm.
Last year, the UN says 31 million people were displaced by climate change and extreme weather events, a number that may soon be higher than those being displaced by conflict. UN weather experts recommend nations strengthen risk prevention measures to save people's lives and reduce damage caused by natural hazards. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. President Joe Biden will get his own look at Hurricane Ida's damage along the United States Gulf Coast. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has those details.
The White House says the president will travel Friday to Louisiana, where Ida became the fifth most powerful storm to strike the U.S., likely causing tens of billions of dollars in damage to the power grid, among other things. At one point, New Orleans was totally in the dark. The power started coming back on today, and spokeswoman Jen Psaki says the president's pushing power companies to work faster.
We know he knows how important it is for people to get power back on.
The visit will cap a rough stretch for the president. As the storm approached Louisiana Sunday, he was in Delaware, watching the remains of 13 service members killed in Afghanistan return to the U.S. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Lawyers for Tanzanian opposition leader Freeman Mbowe, who is facing terrorism charges, have filed another objection to the case after the high court dismissed one earlier in the day. The High Court dismissed the new objections and ordered the case hearing to proceed. But defense lawyers filed another objection, arguing a legal technicality makes the charges invalid. Mbowe's supporters say that the case is politically motivated and have called for his unconditional release. The International Labor Organization's World Social Protection Report 2020 to 2022 reveals the extent to which COVID-19 has devastated the world of work. The report finds that less than half of the world's population is covered by at least one special protection benefit, while 53% have no income security at all. The report calls for national social security policies to be reinforced and for adequate social protections to be extended to workers in all types of employment. U.S. President Joe Biden assured Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Wednesday that the United States remains firmly committed to Ukraine's sovereignty in the face of Russian aggression. Kyiv's troops have been fighting pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine since Moscow unilaterally annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula in 2014. The Biden administration notified Congress last week of an additional $60 million for security assistance. Syed Ali Gilani, who was a top separatist leader and a critic of Indian rule in the disputed Himalayan region of Kashmir, has died at 92. Gilani died late Wednesday, surrounded by family members. Authorities deployed heavy contingents of armed police and soldiers to prevent the funeral from turning into an anti-India protest.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have spotted an accident. It's a brown dwarf located about 50 light years away. A brown dwarf was supposed to be a star, but was unable to gain enough mass to sustain the needed hydrogen fusion at its core to become a full-fledged star. The astronomers gave it its nickname because it was detected by accident and that it's not like any of the other brown dwarfs observed so far. A study published in the astrophysical journal Letters suggests the accident might be 10 billion to 13 billion years old, which is about double the average age of other known brown dwarfs. If it is that old, the astronomers say the accident could have formed early in our galaxy's history and have a different chemical makeup. If so, the scientists propose that there are probably many more of these ancient brown dwarfs nearby in the galaxy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Japan reported a fresh contamination case involving Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine. Reuters Olivia Chan reports it's the fourth such incident in less than a week, threatening to slow the country's sputtering inoculation campaign.
The health ministry said on Wednesday that contaminants in at least one of the incidents were found to be particles of stainless steel. It added that it did not expect the incident would pose an additional health risk. The findings were the result of an investigation by domestic distributor Takeda Pharmaceutical. Takeda said the most probable cause of the contamination was related to friction between two pieces of metal in the machinery that put stoppers on the vials. The company was citing a joint investigation with Moderna and Rovi, which bottles Moderna vaccines. The country suspended the use of over 1.6 million doses of Moderna shots last week after being notified of contamination in some of the supply. The latest incident comes from Kanagawa Prefecture, where almost 3,800 people had already received shots from the contaminated lot, but the rest is put on hold. The Japanese government said earlier that the particles in some incidents may be pieces of rubber caused from needles that were incorrectly inserted into vials, breaking off bits of the rubber stopper.
Olivia Chan of Reuters News. South Africa's jobless rate has hit 34%. Now, that's among the highest in the world, as the country's economy is stifled by the coronavirus pandemic. Linda Givtash reports that black women are among the worst affected at a 41% unemployment rate.
Rebecca Mwale has been sitting in her Johannesburg apartment searching for jobs to no avail since January. The recent graduate from a supply chain management program was already working in the sector when the pandemic struck, and she found herself laid off.
I apply almost every day, but the responses I'm getting, I'm sure I've applied more than 30 times since, but I've only gotten like two responses back. There's not much out here. I actually started applying outside the country.
About 558,000 South Africans lost their jobs last quarter, a period marked by strict COVID-19 lockdowns. The government says the number of job seekers has reached 7.8 million, while an additional 3.3 million people have given up searching. While the pandemic is taking an economic toll, economists like Efficient Group's Davi Root says it's compounded with a historically bleak situation.
I don't think we've turned the corner. I think unemployment is likely to continue creeping up. And unfortunately, it's women that will bear the brunt of all this.
Two decades of experience as a flight attendant for South Africa's national carrier didn't spare Charity Mokomane from job cuts last year. She never dreamed of retraining, but she says she didn't want to leave her husband as the family's sole breadwinner.
When you keep hearing places are shedding jobs, then you think, oh, you know, I can't. I just decided to maybe try and look at other avenues of making money.
She adopted her mother's passion for baking and started selling cakes from her home. Economists say this type of informal entrepreneurship isn't captured in employment data. It means people like Mokimane are still getting by.
And I feel also slightly more in control of what happens to my life. And whatever happens, people have to eat.
But for young job seekers like Mwale, the disruption has curtailed dreams of building a career. The stress has also taken a toll on her mental health.
I did not envision myself depressed and sitting at home. It was not in my plans. I did not even imagine.
South Africa's economy did grow in the first quarter of this year, but economists warn unemployment will remain high for the foreseeable future. Faced with uncertainty, Mwale says all she can often do is pray. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And finally, we circle back to where we began today. As the evacuation of tens of thousands of people from the airport in Kabul was underway, the attempted rescue of dozens of veterinary staff and hundreds of animals from a British animal rescue charity in Afghanistan caught the attention of the media. Their plight led to a heated dispute between the charity and the British government. Henry Ridgewell brings us that story.
Pen Farthing served as a British Royal Marine for 22 years. In 2007, he set up an animal sanctuary in Kabul called Nowzad, named after the first dog he rescued. The charity expanded, eventually employing 25 local staff, including three of Afghanistan's first female veterinarians. Farthing described their emotions when the Taliban seized Kabul on August 15th.
There may be reprisals because, you know, obviously we're a foreign organisation. We've helped soldier rescues in the past, so soldier rescuing dogs. And as I said about the women, you know, what's going to happen to them? Yeah, they're going to be forced because all our women, young women, are single, so they can be forced to marry some Taliban fighter and they just live at home, you know, having these children. I dread to think.
Farthing initially refused to leave Afghanistan without his staff and the hundreds of animals under his care, a mission he named Operation ARC. His cause was followed closely in the British media as a dispute erupted between the charity and the government. Defence Secretary Ben Wallace gave this interview August 24th.
I genuinely believe that they will be allowed to move forward after, you know, at a later date when that airport opens. But, you know, frankly, I have to prioritise people at the moment over pets.
The charity chartered its own plane thanks to a donation from a US-based investor. Several days later, the British government authorised the plane to land and approved the evacuation of the 68 Nowzad staff and dependents and the animals. But the Taliban refused to let them through. Wildlife activist Dominic Dyer has been assisting the campaign from Britain.
And what Penn had was a letter from Downing Street effectively guaranteeing entry for these 68 people. And the Taliban said, well, we don't care what Boris Johnson thinks or says or his involvement. We care what President Biden has decided. And he said, no visas, no entry, and you're not coming in with your people. That was the conversation he had. It was the delays with the Ministry of Defence to get the flight authorization that led to that problem. Because if we'd have got those people to that gate 3 or 4 days earlier with the list we needed to guarantee their entry, with the flight authorization to land the aircraft, we wouldn't have hit that buffer of a change in American rules that basically stopped him getting his people through.
Britain's Defence Ministry did not respond to VOA requests for comment. Farthing escorted his staff away from the airport back through the streets of Kabul. He appealed directly to Taliban leaders via Twitter. On Saturday, the former Marine and his animals were allowed into the airport without his staff. They arrived back in Britain Sunday morning. Pen Farthing has rejoined his wife, who was evacuated from Afghanistan to her home country of Norway. With the Taliban now in full control, the fate of the Nowzad staff and their families remains uncertain. The 140 dogs and 60 cats evacuated from Kabul are now in quarantine in Britain. Nowzad says there have been many offers of new homes for the animals. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And this has been International Edition on The Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.